Good morning, everyone. Today, we will try to connect the two different topics which I have introduced in the last few lessons. On the one hand, we have been talking about various types of sensors for receiving information from outside or from the robot's body. And on the other hand, we have been talking a little bit about the huge field of robot bodies, about actuators, how to interact actively with the environment. And today we should start with a more interesting part which connects these two input and output sides of the robot, how a certain information from the sensory side can be used to change the configuration of the robot's body, of its limbs, can change its position in the environment. And the most important question in this context is that it's not possible to give the robot just a command, move from A to B, for example, because in many cases this will not simply not happen. There are lots of different influences in the environment. Maybe this idea of the robot about what means the other point where it's supposed to, what the target point is meant to be, might be completely different. And also, there's a different frame of reference used by the robot's movements as compared to the robot senses, or possibly also the commands which are specified by the programmer. So if you, for example, remember to the last lecture, I think we ended with just flipping very quickly this slide about the CRAS algorithm. So most of this algorithm actually includes sensory processing. So we have to get a picture of the object which is to be grasped, and we have to analyze the picture in various ways. From these graspable sections, we can identify even more details the three-dimensional structure, and this will give us some kind of point where we can apply our grasping strategies, so we know what are good grasp points, where we can have closure, and where it's unlikely that the object slips out of the grasp, of the grip. In the end, it's really this problem, after having planned the approach and finally having arrived at the object to lift it up. What actually happens is not really part of this algorithm, but it might be a good idea not just to hope that everything is running fine, but also to take into account that maybe during the grasp there might be some kind of disturbances, or I might not really reach in the exactly correct direction, or I might damage the object by my approach towards the object with the arm. And so it's maybe not really a good idea for an algorithm, although here in this context it might do well. In general, that this kind of interaction with the object, with the environment, is completely left out, and one is just hoping that things are going well. And this is what also triggered the historic development of the control theory, control applications. So if you have this kind of steam engine, of course you can make sure that the temperature of the boiling water and outlet of steam and so on is kept at very precise levels. But it was still happening that these machines just exploded, unless there was some very experienced engineer working nearby to make sure that it's not only keeping these values or the state essentially of the machine at certain precise values, but that you are also able to react to any kind of deviations from these values as soon as possible. And so Bolton actually came up with the idea that it might be possible to self-regulate the machine, and what, as everyone knows, I guess, realized this machine in Glasgow, by incorporating some kind of a closed loop into the system. So as soon as the temperature was rising, more steam was produced, and the machine ran faster. And this becoming faster need to be noticed in order to take some kind of counteractions and to balance the speed level of the machine. And this was achieved by the centrifugal governor, which simply, as faster as it turns, lifts these heavy masses here more and more up by the radial forces or centrifugal forces. This didn't really stop the machine by itself, but it was connected to some kind of throttle valve, which reduced the steam flow, so more steam was just let out, and only a part of the steam was used for driving the piston. And in this way, you could stabilize the speed of, or the velocity of the wheel in such a way that it just produces what you needed for your application. In later times, in aerodynamics, it was a very similar situation, that in order to have this kind of flyable airplanes, people were thinking about this idea of inherent stability, to construct an airplane which is such that it somehow rests in midair, maybe possibly stabilized by its own speed. What kind of construction might be optimal in order to have this kind of stable flight, which not lead to sudden drops and any kind of accidents? And it was one of the major breakthroughs achieved by the Wright brothers, that they gave up this idea that the airplane needs to be stable. Yeah? But it was more that they came up with this kind of equation. Of course, you need something which keeps you up there, like wings, and you need some kind of speed in order to be able to use these Bernoullian principles which keep you up. But in addition to this, you need also some kind of control. So in these cases, it was mainly that the pilot itself was in charge of controlling the flaps of the wings in order to balance the airplane. Today, of course, it's mainly done by similar loops as in the governor, but of course in a much more complex way, as you also find it in many other examples of control. So, for example, in initiating spaceflight, it was one of the major problems. If you have an explosive down here, how you can keep really this rocket straight up, how to balance it. That means you need to also throttle some of these jets down here in order really to balance this huge mass on top of this jet which points downward. And other like these ones were also segways were also considered to be quite strange when they first appeared. How can this work, that you balance at the same time as you move or as you stop and things like this. So in other applications like economy, how can we maybe control inflation or control the stock market in a certain way? We know that our present ideas of control are not sufficient, apparently. Nevertheless, there are lots of very successful examples. So just consider this idea, this question of an heater which is controlled in a closed loop fashion. and which is just also meant to serve as an exemplification of the general idea of a control system. So what you have is some kind of a system which you are dealing with. So the control is considered to be outside of the system. This could be, in this case, just this air volume inside the room. There are some quantities with respect to this dynamical system which are of interest. Obviously, this would be maybe temperature, or maybe also in some cases airflow or the temperature differences. You have some way of interacting with the system, so there is some kind of input and output. Of course, you need always to make sure what you are talking about, whether the input is towards or from the system, so to say. So let's say we are looking for the perspective of the controller. So in this case, the input would be the measurement device, and the output from the controller would be the heater. If you look from the system, it's obviously just the other way around. So that's the basic property of a closed loop, that you are not really, that's not easy to separate the two parts which form this loop. And then, of course, you need some kind of actuators in the sense that you can really make some kind of physical changes to the controlled system. And this controller, which performs essentially the relation between input and output. And this can be as easy as this thermostat, which are just binary switches. So as soon as the temperature is below a certain level, they just switch the heater on, and this would already be sufficient to form a fully qualified control loop. Well, similar example we can have in a robot. Now it's again this kind of question of perspective, whether we are, as a programmer, so to say, or as a program inside the robot, are controlling the robot, or whether we want to use the robot in order to affect some kind of changes in the environment, so that we are actually controlling the environment. But be this as it may, let's assume we have this robot in the environment. So the states, like the temperature, would be all kinds of values, that or angles and speeds also of also decrease the freedom of the robots as far as they are interesting for a particular control task. So for example, the grasping controls may not need the speed of the legs, although we know that in biological beings there are all kinds of interactions between the controls of different parts of the body. On the other hand, we have again input and output. So here in this case, from the point of view of the controller, of the brain of the robot, so the sensors and any kind of body parts that are movable, and maybe the robot has motors or maybe artificial muscles or something which really enacts these body parts. And then maybe we have just plugged in a control chip that does everything, or we have to write a control program to derive this sensory information and drive the robot. So the particular problem is now how to make this physical system really to behave as we want. Maybe in some cases it's really helpful if this function is happening naturally. So if you have the problem of controlling a robot to walk on two legs, it's probably a good idea to have a robot which almost walks even without any kind of actuation. Yeah? So in the way of having a very nice mass distribution such that if you move forward, then the leg swings by itself already to the next position. Maybe it does not need to be precise, but if it's almost naturally, then it's also much easier, of course, to follow with the control. So this kind of combination of passive and controlled dynamics might be interesting. Of course, you will have all kinds of perturbations in this case and in most other cases, and the control system needs to deal with these different types of perturbations. So there are a number of questions which we should ask in this context. So if you have a certain goal, can it be reached? And if once it's reached, will you stay there? So maybe reaching a certain goal, like having the steam engine running at a certain speed is something which you can achieve by, you know, by manual control, but stability would be an important question, whether it just stays there. There are these more theoretical questions of controllability and observability, which are like the key concepts in the starting part of control theory. So meaning, if you have a control system, is your control input actually sufficient to achieve a certain action? So if you have a robot and you have no possibility to access the wheels, but only maybe the robot arm, then you will not achieve a controllability of the body. But in some other cases, it seems also hopeless. But you can, by indirect control, you can still achieve controllability. And in the same way, observability, meaning is there a possibility to find out whether anything what I wanted the robot to do actually has happened. So one question which makes things much more complicated, for example, this question how to stand on a single leg with eyes closed, are delays, you know, just by the conduction or possibly also by the inertia. So if you control a ship, it can take several minutes before the ship is showing a satisfactory reaction to a control command. And of course, you can achieve the same with less effort. So a very simple way is somehow to achieve all of these is is actually to be happy with an algorithm or a mechanism rather that is just doing a single thing and at a time and be happy with this effect that this is actually what you wanted to see. So for example, this kind of stop mechanism which just switch off the motor as soon as there is some kind of obstacle detected could be very helpful, like an emergency stop for a robot, and you find often these types of stops in various parts of machines. The question is, you need to make sure really that this distance or the tension of the spring inside here is sufficient really to deal with the inertia, maybe at different speeds of the robot, such that the robot is not really damaging itself or the wall in one of these cases. So in this sense, it might be okay if you have a good idea to about the working regime. Or like in the stepper motor, you can be sure that here inside the box containing the motor, nothing unexpected can happen, and so nothing will interfere with these actions that are initiated there. Another approach is just to remind you is what you have been studying there with Bob previously, this visual servoing algorithm. Some way, if you have information from an image, for example, and you need to change a parameter, so in this case I think it was more abstract, but it could as well be the fingertip of a robot. How can you deal with this? So this follows this kind of idea: you have to sense, you have to plan, and you have to act, and afterwards maybe you should not be too confident and take this step alpha into account, so that if you just move halfway through the to minimize this distance, then you have still a chance to to reiterate and to be able to deal with certain errors which may have led from delta being halved to maybe a different value, but you can still you still have time to deal with it. What is obvious in this case is that there is not really any kind of temporal effect here. So it might be that, of course, you have this kind of do while loop, which somehow implies that each time you run it, there is another time step. But on the other hand, you do different actions, maybe more fast or more slow, during this single time stack, or in the end, when if delta is already very small, then you do only kind of miniature changes, such that it takes a lot of time really to do the last part of the journey or of the movement here in this case. And also it's obvious that it's not so clear in general, especially if you have some kind of smooth continuation of these iterations, so that the object is moving more or less continuously towards this goal of delta being zero, how to choose alpha in such a way that everything goes okay. Huh? But as soon as you can separate these kind of variables, and if you have some kind of idea how to choose Jacobian, then this seems to be a very generic approach. We will discuss some other effects in the next two or three lectures, and it will be, of course, always a kind of similar idea. You have two quantities which simultaneously need to be changed. We would like to take more this kind of perception action loop aspect into account, rather than to start with the sensing action to continue to perform with a sensory event to continue to perform an action, but to have more of this kind of idea what really is the output doing to the input again, and to understand the full behavior of the control loop. On the other hand, we will also deal with continuous systems where it's not this kind of stepwise movement, but it will be also continuous in time. So what is the advantage of a continuous time description, especially in a robotic system, for example, where you can interact with the environment usually only at discrete times or maybe at a certain rate? The question is, what kind of rate is appropriate, and if you have a continuous description of this control problem, then it's often possible to determine what kind of rate of observations or of actions you need in order to solve the problem correctly. On the other hand, also will the robot not be discretely acting, but maybe it can switch in action on, not like a motor, and the motor of course stays on through continuous time, but its speed is only changed or adapted at discrete time points. Now, we will not deal with systems which are non-physical, but it might be good to know that the mechanisms are often being very similar to what maybe is going on in the brain or in social systems as well. So that's what we have seen already, this kind of loop, input to the system, output from the system. If we study control systems, if we think of the controllers, then it would be quite similar, but the other way around. And most of the control problems we deal with are similar to what maybe in a biological context would be called homeostasis, meaning you have some kind of a set point, for example, body temperature of 37 degrees Celsius, and all the control in the there is control in the system that makes sure that actions are taken in order to keep the temperature at this level. So this doesn't need to mean that the robot is stationary in a certain sense. It could mean that the robot has a constant velocity, or it has a constant distance to an obstacle, or maybe is constantly accelerating even. So in order to connect these inputs and outputs, what the robot is required to have is a model. So this model doesn't really need to be some computationally complex structure. It could be just this kind of binary devices that we have seen in the heating thermostat control. So it's implying that you know if you switch on heating that this has some kind of an effect to the room temperature. So in this sense, often this model is more developed in the head of the engineer. But in a more general sense, if there's some kind of desired output, so for example, go back to a certain set point of the control variable, what kind of motor commands are to be done? Yeah? And if we have a measurement which tells us that we are this far from the desired value away, then this inverse model is just a method to calculate what kind of action should be performed in order to have the outcome either in this kind of deadbeat or bang bang control exactly at the set point, or what is maybe more realistic, especially if you are able to control in very short time intervals, maybe just a little bit closer to the set point. On the other hand, of course, we can also ask whether there is a possibility to make some kind of prediction, especially if there is a time delay. So maybe we don't need to control what is going on now, but we need to look into the future. So a forward model could be also helpful in certain cases, in combination typically with a backward model. Or maybe we have also a possibility to connect this model into the loop and to have some kind of a feedback control. So we will deal with all of these later, but today we will mainly start to talk about inverse models. So if you, like I did many years ago, try to have a robot arm here in this case, moved by some kind of components which are not particularly reliable, and also the specification of a certain motor command is not very helpful in this sense, you get very quickly an idea what kind of difficult task you are dealing with. So especially if you consider what really happens before you can maybe move this tooltip here towards the desired position, or even to just to keep it in a noisy environment at a certain position, or maybe against gravity, for example. So we have a number of different coordinate frames which determine the position of the arm. So of course there is maybe our task description, so in the spatial coordinates connected to the lab floor, or where the tip of the robot should extend to. So these have to be calculated in terms of angles of the arm typically. If you have these motors maybe placed near the joints of the arm, we need to find out what this really requires from the motor. And finally, of course, how to control the motor in these cases. So all this chain, maybe here in this case, there's a camera telling what command to apply. So we have to be able to move back and forth through these chains in order to deal with the computation of the robot. Of course, we can maybe try to simplify, and that's what we want to do. So maybe we have a possibility to use a motor which is more predictable, where we can directly apply a command and achieve a certain angle. So in a Capera robot, for example, all this part is performed by a specialized controller which is automatically functioning inside the robot. So as soon as you specify maybe a time or a speed for the wheels, then the robot makes by itself sure to deal with all these steps in between, and you only have to translate between maybe the speed and the position of the Capera, which results from running at this speed for a certain time interval. So in this case, it's quite handy if you have just a single transformation, and that's more or less also the level which we will be dealing with. So it remains for us to be able either to translate a command into an action in order to make a prediction where the robot will be at at waiting after executing this command for some time. Or on the other hand, if we want the robot to arrive at a certain position, what kind of action is necessary for this? And it depends a bit on the complexity of the task, of course, but usually it's possible more easily to go from this side to the other side than to make an inverse calculation. But as we have seen last time, this depends also on the type of robot which you are using. So these inverse models are supposed to find some kind of an action for a desired outcome, which doesn't mean that the solution always exists. So maybe we want the robot to fly or to make a movement which is not possible. So you can make these kind of games with your arms. If you, for example, move around with one arm around the other one, at some point it doesn't work anymore. Of course, you can continue, but this means you have to do a completely different action to reconfigure the arm before you can continue. So in these cases, also, there's not really any particular boundary or the degrees of freedom are not accessible. It can still be that a nearby solution at least doesn't exist, and you really have to replan in order to achieve a solution. On the other hand, it might be that there are many solutions. So you can do the same task with different positions of your elbow, for example. And still, you need to tell the muscles or the motors of the robot what exactly to do. So it cannot be just simply arbitrary in this sense. But you have to choose by some principles, usually keep things as much as possible as they were before as a good principle, by some principle how to deal with this one. So maybe we have a look at an example which is more or less as simple as the one which you were using in the visual servoing task. And here in this case, well, we have maybe a robot arm stretching from the origin to position XY. And we want to change the Y coordinate. For example, think of a crank which drives the piston here. So maybe only the Y coordinate would be the piston, or we want to lift a certain object. So just consider one. So what we can easily establish is this relation between the variable that we control, the angle here in this case, and the variable that is controlled. This height y in this case. Obviously, it's a good idea if you want to calculate the inverse to use this A-tang-2 function. Otherwise, you will always have some kind of problems with the signs. So keep this in mind, very important. So on the other hand, as soon as we want to see what kind of movements we are dealing with, it might be a good idea to consider not only this relation, but to consider differences. Or if we want to go to a continuous description, really differentials. So this would tell us if we do a small change in phi, in the angle here, what kind of change of the height of the end effector would result from this. So in this case, it's quite obvious. There's a factor in between, which obviously depends on the phi itself. So if we do this at very small time steps, we can consider this to be more or less constant. And so we know a small change will relate to a small change with this kind of proportionality factor. So in this way, we have an simpler system than dealing with the original equation, where it's harder to derive precise ideas about the effect of a certain phi. Although you know that there are these possibilities to deal with sine functions, addition and subtraction of sine functions, so it's possible to deal with it more easily. But as soon as we go maybe to other questions in the same model, well, just to deal with this, maybe we like to consider also acceleration. So there is a certain mass, and we have to apply a force in order to achieve some kind of effect. So in these cases, we can go to the Newton's law. Force is equal to mass times acceleration. So we have to calculate the second derivative, and things become also much more complicated in this very simple system. But at least we have an equation which we can program, telling how changes of the angle, or on the other hand, how changes of these changes are affecting our acceleration here, or if we know the mass of the arm, what kind of forces we really need to produce in order to achieve exactly a certain deviation or a certain speed up of the arm at least. So these kind of dynamical models, you can imagine, become quickly very complex, but it's maybe still a good idea to have some approach which is not really dependent on a particular shape of the control principle, but which can deal with a larger class at least of systems. And for this purpose, it's maybe a good idea to remind ourselves the differential equation. So what kind of changes are happening in physical systems or in real systems, engineering systems, or how do different changes interact with each or connect or are related with each other. So usually you have simply this form which describes everything what we will be dealing with and much more actually. You know that at a given time the system has a certain state which is specified by one part of this differential equation, by the initial condition. And then you know if the system has a certain state which can depend on the system itself or maybe also on these control inputs, what will be the effect on the particular quantities, so x can be any kind of vector describing the system, what will be the effect on these vectors. This f could, for example, contain the changes in any kind of angle, and that's what we get out from this, or possibly any other robotic task. So this is not meant to really be discussed here in a direct sense. It's just one example which should explain what is the relation between a differential equation on the one hand, relating a quantity to its derivative, and the solution of this equation. So it's actually possible going through these steps here to arrive at the solution, which not like this ones here gives a kind of structure, a kind of general observation. So what is the relation between an object and a change? But it's really able from this description to tell about the fate of this object. So here, once you have specified this mathematically, you can go to the solution. And this solution just tells you, if you know that you have started at a certain time, if time proceeds beyond the starting time, where actually you will end up. And that's something which is really fascinating, because often these kinds of relations can be established just by looking at systems, and this really tells you about or by modeling the system, but it doesn't really require to observe the system for a long time. What you see here is a tendency of the system for arbitrary long time, and you are able to predict really what the system is doing. So this was really striking in the 18th century when people came first into contact with these kind of equations. So this seems always possible. Well, you just have to make a single observation over a short time interval, how this relation is B, or as Laplace said it, you need just to know all the state and maybe the velocities of the all particles in the universe, and then you can predict solving this equation, going to some kind of solution, you can really predict what will be the most distant future. So obviously overgeneralized this kind of differential equation principle a bit, but it took at least 150 years to understand why there are still some problems left which cannot be covered, even if you have all the information, so which is of course another problem here. For a robot, that's nice to know. Yeah? So as soon as we have a description of our robot, possibly by such a relation between effects in a robot and the state at a given time, then we can be sure that the robot behaves exactly as planned, unless obviously there is either an error here in our model, or there are some kind of other effects that in addition to the essentially well-modeled quantity interfere with the long-term perspective of the robot. Yeah, so just to remind you, this equation here implies two types of movements, so it depends on the parameter. Either it can just explode, increase faster than any kind of linear function, or if alpha, if this A is negative, then you have decay, and that's a nice property in many cases that you know that the system settles down. And that's probably also what you have seen in this visual servoing task. That you can essentially choose, so there it was called alpha, I think. You can choose whatever alpha you want. You always decay to this kind of goal value. Maybe sometimes it takes longer or quicker, but the convergence is, so to say, guaranteed as long as A is, in this case, smaller than one, smaller than zero, or in the case of the visual servoing, smaller than one. So why there is this difference should not bother us too much at this moment. But one question is that this kind of relation between solutions and differential equations is particularly obvious if you have linear differential equations. So linearity means essentially, mathematically something like this, but that if you have two solutions, you can just add them and you will still have a solution of the problem, which is a nice property, but in most of the robots you don't have this property. If you have an action, performing an action from here to here, just doing twice the action will not work. And so in this way, the hope just to solve all the problems by studying a little bit more mathematics might be not completely in vain, but it will not really solve all the problems. Yeah, just consider this particular example here. Again, a very similar structure to this visual servoing problem. So what we have is a robot which is maybe supposed to move along a wall, so we're looking from the top to the robot. And maybe we have some kind of idea that the robot should keep a distance to the wall constant. So as if the robot really heads in the optimal direction, we don't have to worry about anything, but typically there will be some kind of small deviation leading to a deviation also of the distance to the wall. So how can we deal with such a problem? Well, we can just try to make some kind of changes to this delta in such a way that we go back to this x star. Yeah? So we could write something like this. So this deviation, yeah, it needs to be noticed at some in some way. So for example, we have a distance sensor which can tell us this kind of deviation should be translated into a change of the current heading direction. So for example, if you have a change of maybe 5 units here, we know that we need to do k times 5 units for changing the delta. If you implement this in this robot, maybe you can spend some time to find out what k would be. It's obviously depending on the time the robot needs to move from here to here, and of course on the sine of the angle. So it's possible to calculate this, but what you often find is that it doesn't really solve the problem in the sense. So you move, the robot moves a bit, and as soon as it is, has sensed and reacted accordingly, then maybe you end up in a position, just let's say here, where now the theta is pointing in the correct direction, but obviously while you were deviating, so it took some time before we noticed it, reacted to this, so the x is not correct anymore. So what happens is that the robot would result in some kind of wiggly behavior, which if it's very small could not would not really hurt, but it's not really what we want the robot to do. We just wanted to have some kind of straight movement. So the problem is simply that these two variables are of course connected by the controller itself, but also there is some kind of intrinsic connection between the two variables in the sense that if I move with a certain angle, then this will also change the x, while changing theta doesn't automatically have an effect to the distance. So the robot can just turn in place and will not affect in any way the distance. So for as a practical approach, it might be maybe better not to bother too much about these control principles, but to maybe get a good map to tell the robot, if you are maybe more than this distance away, just move back as soon as possible to this distance, meaning that you and then maybe you should make sure that you readjust the angle to what you believe is the correct heading angle. If this belief or this map or the internal model is not exactly correct, or if the map is not in sync with the environment, then maybe it's possible to make sure to get some kind of information, just to move more close towards the wall, that it's possible to readjust the map again. So in this way, there's a possibility to disentangle the problem, to deal with both questions separately, given the precise information, or the relatively precise information about the environment, which would leave, of course, the control theory in a bad status. So what we need to do is we need to add some more terms to the control problem in order to solve this kind of undulating problem which we have, which the robot would propose us. But of course, as soon as you have the situation more under control, there are typically lots of other possibilities to simplify the problem. So we will probably rather next time have a look at some detailed example which tells us how we can achieve a similar behavior where you do not really have this kind of oscillations here, but more of a smooth convergence to the desired values. But for today, it's maybe enough to say that control is often not a simple task. There are some standard schemes which are in many cases, maybe in 97% of all controllers, helpful. And we will deal with these ones, in particular considering these ideas of position control for a robot. Thank you for your attention.